You're listening to an M Pavilion podcast. We acknowledge the people of the Eastern Kulin Nation as the traditional custodians of the land on which M Pavilion stands. We pay our respects to their elders past and present, and extend that respect to the traditional custodians of the land where you're tuning in from, around Australia and across the globe.
Welcome, and welcome to M Pavilion number 10. I think you are, the second audience to be in here after the opening, so thank you all for being here. It is an incredibly beautiful pavilion to be in, and we are delighted to be one of the first to be speaking here. So our speakers here today have been here for the Living Cities Forum. Did anyone manage to go to the Living Cities Forum yesterday? Yeah, I can see a few nods, yes. And I can see some raising of the non-roof part at the back there as well. So we're lucky enough to have the speaker who opened the forum with incredibly kind of propulsive energy yesterday and the speaker who closed the forum. We have Keller Easterling, who is an architect, writer, professor at Yale, author of a whole complement of books that I'm sure that many people here have on their shelves. And yesterday, Keller closed the Living Cities Forum by taking the audience on a ride through infrastructural space, which is again something we are going to be talking about today. And our second speaker, also was incredibly the talk of the session yesterday, Nashin. Nashin runs a Southeast Asian non-for-profit developing humanitarian tech for community-led disaster co-management. And that concept of co-management is something that we'll be talking about again today. So we're here to talk about humane AI. That was the task that Sam over here gave to us. And it was an interesting conversation when we were discussing what that actually meant for us. Certainly AI, it's absolutely been the topic of the year. It is not the first time we've been talking about this, though. You know, as back as sort of far as the 40s and 50s, we have been talking about computational power. Can that be decoupled from other kinds of power? What does that mean? But certainly in the last couple of years, and certainly this year, I'm sure that everyone has seen things like ChatGTP rocking to the kind of top of the news pages, Midjourney, conversations about what it means to be engaging with this kind of technology, who gets to create this technology, who is, what affordances are opened by this. We hear that it will help solve major ecological crises. We hear that it is going to be something that can be incredibly harmful to us. We hear that maybe it will do nothing, that all of these kinds of different conversations. So while Australia and other countries are trying to work out what this means in terms of governance, while communities are trying to figure out what it means in terms of how they engage with it and indeed often what it actually means, and in the week that a company founded by two ex-Apple employees called Humane have released an AI pin, which is either threatening or promising, depending on your perspective, to replace our screens, we're going to talk about a different kind of being humane in the context of AI. So Nashin, I wanted to start with you, and I was reading an article that you wrote from a few years ago now, where you used a Guattari quote as your opener. You may or may not remember this, that said, "New technologies foster innovation and madness in the same flow," which seems apt for the topic of conversation today. You talked in that article and yesterday around how kind of onslaughts of information are just fundamentally changing the way that we engage with, take on board, understand information, but more importantly, that they are potentially physiologically actually changing the way that we operate. So given this potential kind of neuroplastic reorganizing, what do you think humane actually looks like when it comes to technology, and what would need to be in place for technology to be more humane?
Well, I'll first to say that's a big question, and so I will try my best, but I think for technology to be more humane, first of all, like, we need to think about the structures by which it is that technology is owned and managed and governed, but also going back to this question about what technology is doing to our brains and why I used that quote in that article, which I actually don't remember which article it is, but along the same time, like recently, and there's been a lot of research about epigenesis, which is the idea that our brains are they're not predetermined, and that our environments are shaping our brains, and cultural practices shape our brains. And so, what does it mean then when we have algorithms that are operating at speeds much faster than decision making? So, like, if the nerves in our brains are operating like 50 milliseconds per hour and the per minute, and we have the sort of internet systems operating at 200 milliseconds an hour that have the capacity to target decision making before we are even consciously aware of them. We need to ask who has control of those systems, but then also the other side of that, the promising side of that, that comes from philosopher Catherine Malabou. She says that the fact that our brains are plastic and this whole research about epigenesis means that there's actually a potential for revolt, because there is the possibility to rewire our brains that doesn't need to be centrally controlled. And the fact that our brains physiologically, but also in the way that we think, that they can be controlled by different sources, it also means we have the power to inflect that. And I think with that thought, it's about how are we able to achieve that, which goes back, I think, to much deeper sort of structural issues and ideologies about where is knowledge held, how is it created, where is access to technology concentrated, and how can we think about more distributed ways of reworking that.
Kala, I might throw that over to you. What does it also actually mean for you to think about being humane in this context?
Well, I think I agree that with Nushin that, you know, what one's looking at is not the technology itself. The technology is not a steady state. The technology is itself an actor, and it's acting on us, and we're acting on it, and so on. But it's almost one's looking for the shape of it and for the mix of it. We probably all have friends who think that, you know, AI will like solve the world, and, you know, like we need to put all of our computing power to solve climate crisis, you know, instead of Facebook or something like that. But the shape of that seems wrong to me, because it's a monism, you know, it's bringing things back into one authority. So it seems to me that it's more like the mixture of technologies and the mixtures of different kinds of information. So, as Gregory Bateson said, you know, a man, a tree, and an axe is an information system. This, the way we are arranged, is an information system, even in all of our lumpy, you know, fleshiness. I am always, I mean, what I, the side I'm trying to sit on is to be constantly introducing the heavy information into that mix, because I know that there'll always be a lot of enthusiasm, especially now, about the digital information. So it's, but I'm just sort of arguing that what's really, if it's just digital information, it can actually ironically be information poor. But it gets information rich when there's many different species of information in the mix.
Nushin, this is an excellent segue back to you in terms of what it means to have these kind of many different types of information, many different kind of data streams, many different kind of sources, from this big data to rich data to thick data. Can you talk a little bit about the work that you do and how you've been thinking about that in your practice?
Yeah, We're building open source tools for climate adaptation. How it works is that we built a software that can plug into social media to crowdsource information about disasters and put this on a map in real time. And that map is used by residents and government agencies and first responders to coordinate during disasters. But it's not data mining in that it's not just that we're scrapping data from social media, but we're using that to identify posts with certain keywords like flood or fire or earthquake. And then we have a bot that sends an automatic reply to the user asking them, are you really experiencing this? And so one, I just want to point out what that does is that, and what we're thinking about is that in a time where, again, there's all of, so much around us, there's this belief that we just need AI to solve everything. What we're really trying to think about in our work is let computers do what computers do best and let humans do what humans do best. We don't need to build really expensive verification systems for the computer to process whether that person is really in a flood when we can just ask them, are you in a flood? And then the other thing that we built into that system is that if people respond to that question, are you in a flood or are you in a fire, is there a way that they can easily submit that information to us that is meaningful to them? So for flood, it was very easy in that, you know, we had a really little graphic because in Indonesia, people talk about flood based on their body height. So they would just in conversation, you say, I'm in a flood, and it's like ankle deep or waist deep. And so we, in the way that we ask people to input flood information, is that we have a little graphic of a person and a car, and like you move the slider up and down. So that's really simple. But about enrolling other knowledge, like different forms of knowledge, I think the best example was that when we were building out the feature to report about air quality and haze, the government has sensors around some cities that measure air quality based on PPI. Obviously, like when we're talking, we're not going to talk about air quality and PPI. So when we were working with communities, it was like, how do you know if it's safe to go outside or to drive? And the way they describe air quality is based on respiratory symptoms. And so we designed that method of input then that they would they would share information with us based on respiratory symptoms that we set, but then we align that with the study of how, like, based on historical information, how does that actually align with the PPI, so that we could actually build up like a complementary data set where we have that sensory information as a valid source of info, but then recognizing that government agencies are also using our tool, they also have assurance that there is a equivalent to the metrics that they are measuring.
And just to clarify for anyone who didn't see you speak yesterday, can you remind us how many people are currently using the system that you're talking about, the platform?
Our project started in Indonesia. We're now in about 7 countries, and there are about 500 million users of the platform.
It's pretty impressive. Kicking back over this side, we've just heard from Shin this kind of beautiful example of how thinking about technology, thinking about computers in terms of what are you good for, what are we good for, how does that start to work together in a really meaningful way as an incredibly generative and productive way to be developing up information systems. I know a lot of your career, you've been thinking about systems that perhaps haven't necessarily been as productive or generative for a wider range of people. Could you talk us through some of your work around kind of informational systems, and particularly those kind of shadowier systems that are potentially sitting behind some of these kind of extraordinarily large, all-pervasive tech platforms?
Well, I'm often looking at what I'm calling spatial products, but they're kind of the instructions for making vast amounts of repeatable formulas for space. Everything from, you know, parking lots and malls and resorts and ports and all those things that are kind of sprawling all across the world. So it's that the instructions, I assume is what you're talking about, the instructions for how to make that are the kind of the real architecture for a lot of people who are the sort of shadow architects of most of what's being made in the world. They're kind of org men, you know, who are making space out of time and money and disgorging populations of consumers from one place to another place in ways that are timed, you know, like the figuring out how long it takes one spouse to play golf and the other one to do a leisure, to, you know, do a spa or something. And then they create a kind of leisure conglomerate around that information. So the kind of enclosure, like the building, is kind of like an afterthought. Like, it's sometimes even called frost. It's like, it's not like what an architect would think of as a building, or like, you know, this is a building. So it is mostly a kind of logistical calculation when there's a kind of some solids that are precipitates of that. But there are also, to kind of get back to some of the things that Nashim was talking about yesterday, you know, they also, however much they are precipitates of a kind of bottom line, they're also kind of dressed up in all kind of puffy fairy tales and desires and, psychological attractors and so on.
Nashim, you've also written a little bit about this in the context of these kind of imaginaries and these desires and these potential future kind of images of different places, different urbanisms, and how that can then potentially be something that is also kind of undermining to having a richer and more kind of plural, messier, wonderful city. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I think that comes from, most immediately from, maybe some of you have heard that Indonesia is moving its new capital, its capital from Jakarta to Kalimantan. Especially in that scenario, but we see it all over as well. There is this aspiration that when things are too messy, like in Jakarta, what do? Let's just start over. But that's not really how things work. And what that does, especially in situations like this, and I worry also with, we're seeing this with climate change, where the language of crisis is brought on to push one vision of the future, where because we're in a crisis, there is only there is so much urgency, and there's this only one thing that we must do, and that's usually a techno-capitalist solution. And what that does is suppresses other ways of imagining about the future, but then also that insistence of the singularity of the presence forgets or suppresses the traditions and the histories that have led up to that moment, and all of the parallel ways that we can think about different futures. And I think that's really that's really alarming when we foreclose the possibility of doing different things through the language of crisis, insisting that there's only one way because we don't have time, when I don't think that's ever really the case. If there's a crisis, what we really need is more imagination and more different ways of doing things.
Nashim was also here a few months ago talking about Jakarta, and you told a really interesting story around the fact that we build in floodplains and then it floods, because of course it does, it's a floodplain. But then we're in a flood. You know, there is a kind of language and a framing of that as something that is an urgency, that is a disaster, as opposed to understanding how we might potentially just learn to live in a very different way with those natural systems. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so I think flood is also a very anthropocentric word, because exactly, we built, it is the tendency of the river to overflow from its banks at some seasons of the year and then to come back. And that's Dilip Takuna explains, this is the river breathing. This is the natural process of the river. And when we come and build settlements on that, within that flood pulse, then we say, now this is a crisis because the water is in my way, when in fact it's the settlements that have encroached on that natural breathing. So I think we need to also consider how we frame that language of flood and think about, if we thought about it from a different perspective, is that really a crisis that, in many cases, that we've brought on ourselves? And when I hear in Australia, there's a lot of discussion about housing, but also in other parts of the world, for those who can't afford it, it tends to be built in areas that are most at risk, and that areas that we shouldn't be building on in the first place. Jakarta as a city was built on a swampland, and we shouldn't have been building a city for 31 million people on a swampland. It wasn't built to sustain that, and now we call that a crisis. But to address that, we're doubling down on what we've always known and continuing to build on top of that, saying that we need to manage the water because the water is the thing that's the problem, when the fact is the water has always been there, and there are ways to live with the water that have existed for generations, and maybe it's time to bring those knowledges back and accepting the fact that the climate is volatile, the environment is volatile, and there are ways of adapting to that rather than insisting that the environment has to behave in a singular linear way all year round because we want to carry on economic activities all year round without having to adjust any of our habits.
Kelly, you have also been thinking about this a lot in terms of what are the other ways that we can be switching dispositions, and you used a beautiful term yesterday about being sneaky with this. Can you share a little bit about that?
Well, I think this is a little bit talking about forms of activism and not wanting to say, you know, there's one right way to do activism, because that sort of makes it very easy for the political superbugs to outwit you, to run rings around you, but that it's stronger to be inconsistent, stronger to be patchy, stronger to create a kind of dissensus that keeps them disoriented and sometimes even starving them of the fight they are, you know, angling for. And, it'd be interesting to talk about. It kind of came up yesterday a couple of times in the background is Hong Kong and the Hong Kong protests. Because it's a really graphic way of talking about these kinds of mixtures of technology. Because they were very smart, the activists. They very deliberately did not send their signal in all the way to the internet, because that, you know, that brings it back to one thing, and that brings it back to a potential kill switch, so that everything would drop. Instead, they used a kind of Bluetooth program called BridgeFi, which would let them sometimes gather in ways and then sometimes broadcast. So from your phone, you could broadcast maybe, I think it was like 300 feet or something like that. So little clumps of people could kind of come together and then also dissipate. And everybody knows that the Hong Kong activists said, you know, be water. You can't shoot water, which meant that they were supposed to have that kind of agility. But it was the program that was mixing human bodies, you know, heavy human bodies, and light signals that would allow them to, you know, as they said, gather like mist, evaporate like dew, that, you know, and be water. And they also were incredibly careful to study some of the cagiest and smartest and mediagenic activists, they would very deliberately do things that were filled with human bodies, like really bulky. They did an homage to the Baltic Line that was the 400-mile line that went through Lithuania and Baltic states after 1989, but theirs was slightly shorter, you know. And they also did things like gather what they called sort of these silver gatherings. You know, they would have only old people, you know, so you couldn't be like angry at the old people, you know. It was just all very, very, very clever all the time, but successful, you know, in terms of our conversation because of the mix, you know.
Nishin, picking up on this idea of kind of many, many people in many different kinds of assemblages, again, there's a huge number of people who are engaging with your platform. There's this incredible kind of bringing together of people engaging in a participatory way, but that can also be like quite a messy and challenging space to work in. So can you talk to us a little bit about how you've found that experience?
It's messy in that everyone is using it for a different purpose, but then for us it's okay because as I mentioned yesterday, we all have different worldviews, and it's not necessary that we agree with each other in order to live together or like act collectively during moments of crisis. And through the platform, what we're trying to do is allow for different ways of people to self-coordinate. And so it's not a prescribed way of like everyone who's using it is doing this one particular thing, but everyone everyone has access to it and is able to use it in different ways. So like you don't, so a, like a family might use it just to coordinate for the safety within their own family. I need to know when to pick up my kids from school, if the road is flooded, which areas to avoid. But then government agencies are obviously using it in a very different manner. But that also means that we have to pay attention to the different ways that the information is used and pay attention to the type of risks that may emerge. And for example, one of the risks is that we identified very early on before we started to even develop it was that because disasters are highly politicized, we would never store the information of the user. And that like that is something we could already identify from the beginning, that all of the reports have to be anonymous. And though we received some pushback from certain central agencies who were like, no, we need to know who reported, because again, there's different language that they use that like we needed to know for validation. Otherwise, like if we don't have the identity of the person, there's no validation of the information. First of all, that was problematic to us because then the word like citizenship is also problematic because only those who are recognized by the state can participate, and we didn't want to have that. But the other part of it was that we know that that's just a language that's co-opted for other sort of targeting. And by understanding that, we could identify that, no, we are going to, you know, remain steadfast on our position that this is anonymous and never even store that information. So we have to pay attention to what are the types of things that may happen, what are the different types of ways that this could be used, but never really directly sort of impose that you have to use this in a certain way.
You know, we haven't had a chance to talk about this yet properly, but because we were talking about Ushahidi as one of the kind of precedents for your open source platform. Ushahidi was a, I mean, you can probably say this better, but Ushahidi was an open source platform that started, it means witness in Swahili, and it was started in Kenya to so that people could witness an election and kind of keep it, you know, open, above board, less corrupt, but then that open source platform could be used for like many, many different things, for health things, for also natural disasters and things like that. But it was so interesting because that bit of code, if you change just a bit of that code, there was another platform, very similar kind of cousin platform by someone called Nathan Eagle, who made this platform into a platform that would help companies find the next middle class in the global South? You know, like so, it was like reporting, preferences and so on. But it, just a little bit of code, you know, if you looked at it, if you saw the app, you know, you wouldn't be able to tell just by looking at it that it had, that the two things had very different dispositions. You know, one had a Swahili name, the other, of course, Sanskrit name, you know, which is the cleansing, you know, name. But it's that kind of thing that you have, I'm guessing you have to be constantly vigilant about who's going to try to poach that data.
Yeah, and that's why, like, even though like we've built the initial code 7 years ago, like we're still constantly changing it because we have to pay attention to all of the different sort of socio-political happenings. And as we go into different countries, there are different things that we need to pay attention to that we wouldn't have considered in Indonesia. And then that alters how we write the code and what sorts of things we have to try and anticipate. And so I think another word that we use is, and this is anastrophic design. So a catastrophe is the future coming apart, and anastrophe is the future coming together. So it's having to like try and see that like 10 steps ahead and build towards that, not just for this particular moment.
And just before, I think we're heading over to questions soon, so start getting them ready. But I wanted to ask both of you, we were just talking about design activism for, and this came up a lot at the session yesterday. We were also talking about being humane, which means being humane within yourself as well. How do you continue to do this work, to be optimistic about this work? What is it that kind of drives you to continue operating in this space, given the size and scale of some of these challenges?
Well, there's an expression in the United States, whistling through the graveyard. I don't know if this means a sort of a fake optimism, fake confidence when you're really scared. I don't know. I think that part of it does have to do with, as we were talking about yesterday, not looking for solutions, but looking for the potency of problems and how problems can go together. And there's plenty of problems. And in my profession, the architecture profession, you know, usually you're just waiting for a highly capitalized client to give you some kind of assignment. Trying to find, you know, some kind of opportunity in the way capitalism inevitably fails and is inevitably thin and puny compared to all this heavy information that we're talking about, and even compared to the problems that it discards. You know, yesterday I tried to show a slide of, you know, something that had been a house that had been a trafficked mortgage product, but when it stops having any kind of value to capital, it turns back into a house. You know, it turns back into like wood and stuff you can work with. And so there's something very tempting about just practically very tempting about problems to me, and maybe just because there's something that's the moment where you can kind of like roll up your sleeve when the puny abstractions that are creating so much of a deadlocked world, you know, kind of creating a world in which we feel like, well, we can't really do anything, you know. It's when capital fails and when all these systems fail and leave behind stuff that you can put together, that is exciting in a way. So it's kind of strangely exciting at moments of failure.
Nishin, same question to you.
Well, I think just picking off of that, I think the affordance of living in Jakarta is we see all of these the failures are constantly occurring, but then people are putting together livable forms of habitation. And actually, that's while I understand, like, will we all understand those are undesirable circumstances? The fact is, we all have agency, even though it can feel like these challenges can feel incredibly overwhelming. And like, what can I do? But when we see that, it's like all of us have agency to start from where we are with our own communities. We are each part of community and extend that out. And it doesn't have to extend out to 500 million. It can just start in within our own spaces. I think there's an incredible power to just starting.
How did you just start?
I think I fell into it. The fact is that we, growing up in Jakarta, we grew up with floods. And so it was, like, as a kid, it was being aware that, like, every 5 years the water would enter the house, and then we would, you know, see the marks on the walls, and every 5 years it was rising, and then it was more frequently than 5 years. And so to have that directly impact us, like, as a kid, it's like that, in one way, it's like this is expected, but it's also very disruptive to our lives as children. It's like, I wanted to go to the library. Like, why can't I go? Like, why is this constantly disrupting my life? But at the same time, another affordance of living in Jakarta is that there are inequalities all over the world, but in Jakarta, it's very visible. And I think by seeing that, it's the question we ask ourselves then is that, we can't help but ask, how do we address that inequality? If the flood was an inconvenience for me because I couldn't go somewhere, it was an inconvenience, it was a much bigger inconvenience to someone else because it was destroying their livelihoods. And bearing witness to that is very painful, I think, even as a child or as you're growing up. And there's like a call that something must be done about this. And if all of the consultants that we're, like, all of the climate adaptation money is going to are clearly not addressing the problem, then we don't need to wait for someone to solve it. We can do something about it.
And with that, do we have any questions from the audience? Jeffrey Robinson, I know you've got a question. The mic is coming towards you.
Thanks very much. I mean, I'm so impressed with the work. I saw you when you came and spoke in the Melbourne School of Design last year or earlier in the year, and I was impressed, and it's great to see how things have developed. My question is really about the applicability of some of that kind of crowdsourcing of information and how perhaps we might be able to use it in Australia. You know, we do have floods here, so maybe there's a direct application, and maybe your app is already being used. I don't know whether it is or not. But we're also going to have situations where I think some of the disasters in Australia are on their way. And what I mean by that is that we continue to build suburbs and places without sufficient tree cover in really hard areas, and our climate's going to get hotter and hotter. And I was wondering about the applicability of your platform or other platforms for people to actually perhaps identify in their suburbs, you know, the lack of tree cover and the potential disasters that could come, and how, you know, that could be used for councils to say, actually, you need to put more shading and things in different areas. Just your thoughts on how perhaps your platform could be used in Australia to avert some of the things that we have here, disasters or potential disasters.
Do I answer that? Okay, thank you for the question. So the software is designed to be adaptable to a wide range of geographies and concerns as well. So definitely it could be used in Australia for flooding and other situations. And we just recently formed sort of a global alliance. So if you or anyone here is interested in implementing it in Australia, please do reach out. But just to give an example of like other use cases, it's not just being used for disaster mapping. So like in Hong Kong, there's a group using it to coordinate food waste. And so the same software is being used to coordinate crowd logistics in terms of the distribution of food at like last hour of closing time of restaurants. And it's extremely enriching because the fact that they're using it for a different use case is actually beneficial for us because we are learning from them to reapply that to an emergency context in Indonesia now. But yeah, all to say that it is adaptable. Some other groups are using it to monitor the soil quality for the growth of crops. And so really it can be used for anything where crowdsourced information is useful to map things in real time. That can be used. Our purpose is that it can be used for decision making in real time. But then, of course, because that data is there, it can be accumulated and used to create arguments for planning or policy making.
Right over here. Jeffrey, could you? Oh, Mike's coming. Andrew.
I wanted to ask a question about flooding, but a different kind of flooding, a disinformation flooding, I suppose, and to remember that time that Steve Bannon talked about the solution there was to basically flood the zone with shit. Just to disinformation, you know, was the way to win any election. And we've seen, in Britain, we've seen Brexit basically won by a lie, and we've seen the famous handshake of Zuckerberg and Trump promising to sell billions of dollars worth of personal information that could be then weaponized individually to individual voters with their fears wrapped up in a political slogan. And it just seems like every election now, the atmosphere is rising. And then you add AI into that and the potential for absolutely flooding our election processes with disinformation. We just had The Voice, which was flooded by Advance Australia rubbish. And I guess my question is whether the looking at flooding in a physical sense, is there a way, talking to, you know, Ushahidi and that experience in Kenya, trying to keep elections kind of visible, is there a corollary in the world of capital P politics and elections, where we as citizens somehow can use AI and technology as a kind of reflex against this other kind of flooding of disinformation.
It's the technology is not the steady state. The technology is not the thing. It's like the shape of the technology, the mix of the technology. So what you're proposing, makes a lot of sense because it's taking the disposition of the organization away from something that's centralizing the authority and somehow, you know, redistributing it, mixing it with lumpier things, and changing who gets to look at, so that it's more of a kind of constellation, a web of vision, rather than vision coming to one, you know, center. At the same time, I always am trying to tempt my students to get off of social media because of the way in which it purports to be information rich, but when you filter it through a binary of likes and dislikes, it actually then becomes information poor. It just becomes a violent binary. But I'm trying to tempt my students because people like Zuckerberg and others who have concentrated so much wealth, you could say have made it really convenient for us, you know, because like if they could all just at one point like unsubscribe, you know, they would like, they wouldn't even have to go out into the street to march. You know, this is like a lazy form of activism where you could bankrupt people, or thank them for their hoarding of wealth. You know, this makes activism very convenient. Makes killing them very convenient. You know,
I don't know what more I can add to that. I think, but I think that's a very pertinent problem. We are also having elections in Indonesia next year, and I'm extremely worried about this. But there are activist groups also that are working to sort of reroute or to, I don't know if reroute is the right word, or like to counteract some of this. In Brazil, there's a group called Coding Rights, and they were doing this with elections there. They were successful to an extent, but it's very difficult if you're a small activist organization with very few resources compared to the government. So I'm not really sure. I'm convinced by Keller's approach. I think then we have the power because they've identified themselves so easily.
Over here.
Thank you for the conversation. So it's kind of a comment and then a small question, but I guess I'm wondering about thinking long-term future of this, and even it's a bit of a shot at the title. No offense, Sam, but the relationship between human and technology. And I sort of have this inner thought that anytime you put humans and technology and capitalism as a triad, it's just dystopian. There's no good ending with capitalism, technology, and humans running everything. But then I keep thinking, you know, that's always the fear of the dystopia against AI, that it's going to overtake, it's going to oversmart us. And you can probably imagine where I'm going with this from my talk yesterday and thinking, like, we're so focused on human to human and AI and what it does between us, we're forgetting about the non-human world. And we now know science is backing up that our trees are communicating with each other under the ground, animals are communicating with each other, birds are giving messages. The Ojibwe people in Canada talk about they can talk, literally they understand what the birds are saying to them. And when they speak their language, the birds understand them because they've heard that language, just like your dog understands you. Makes sense, right? If an animal's heard your language for thousands and thousands of years, they can communicate. So I kind of think like maybe the optimism for me is that AI actually may give us the opportunity to actually ask the trees. Like a lot of First Nations people in Canada say, there's no such thing as land stewardship. What's that mean? Why do you think you have to take care of that? Because Mother Earth will take care of you. It's not like that. Nobody's taking care of anybody. You're actually, to your earlier point, Keller, we're all systems of information exchange. Our brain is one part. The internet is one thing. AI is going to be another thing. And then there's the non-human world. So I'm wondering if you put thought towards AI's potential to maybe it liberates humans from this false perception that we're in control of the world, and there's another level of information exchange that's beyond us that might actually help us with communicating literally with the rest of the environment.
Yeah, I'm so glad you said that, because I mean, to be called a human is an insult in a way, you know, because to what our humanities are made up of the last 500 years of white enlightenment, whiteness, white enlightenment, modern, you know, thinking, and that it's a phantom body that doesn't even have anything to do with what we are, or certainly not the capacities of this organism, and it excludes all of the other information. So when someone says, you know, you're a real human being, this just seems like such a terrible insult, you know, I don't know what the possibilities are for those kinds of exchanges, but those would be the productive light forms of signaling, maybe.
I might jump in on this one as well. I was talking about this with a colleague the other day who pointed me to a quote from Sacha Poloff, which I'll paraphrase probably quite badly. But he was talking about the fact that so much of what happens in the world is so far beyond human register because either it's too big or it's too small. We not only can't kind of contain it within our own brains, but we actually can't understand it. We can't measure it. We don't have ways of doing that. And my colleague's kind of great hope is that AI will actually let us take in these massive amounts of data, start to do some different kinds of sense-making between this. And some of the examples that he was pointing to were applications that are quite small at the moment but have kind of extraordinary potential around things like, you know, you can use AI at the moment to detect birds and you can detect which are the endangered birds. So it helps you to calculate and capture much more quickly and understand where bird life is in a particular place. And then you can start to put in implementations and mechanisms to then start to move towards change around that. So I think there is something really interesting about thinking about this in kind of ecological time and in a planetary boundaries sense. And rather than thinking about, yes, it can help me to get my shopping to me slightly quicker because I don't really have to wait 24 hours to get my groceries in, we can start thinking about it in the context of what does it actually mean for much more systemic change. But in order to do that at scale, I think it does take a fairly significant disposition shift.
Yeah, as long as it doesn't keep us from developing the underexploited parts of this organism, you know, the way in which we are Wilbur, you know, like we have like a canine sense, we haven't worked on it, you know. So as long as we don't try to like put on another artificial layer in typical human style, you know, instead of developing those powers ourselves.
Yeah, attempting to actually listen and engage rather than anthropomorphize and speak to it back in that language. Shen, did you have something?
I mean, just going back to the example you shared about being able to understand the birds, I think these are things that many traditions have known for a long time. And my issue always with the word AI is like, I don't think I agree with the definition of intelligence in the way that it's being used, because my view is that intelligence is embodied, and if it's of the world, because it's of how to participate in the world. And so it goes back to this question of what can we do best, what can computers do best, and how do we complement those. I think it's about learning to pay attention again to the type of knowledges that actually we have, that we are capable of, but that we've sort of been distracted from learning to read signals in the environment. It's not learning to read how the trees behave, even if we don't know exactly what they're communicating. There has always been an understanding of that there is an interrelationship, and I think trying to bring back that diversity of knowledge is equally as important. And then how can computational tools act sort of as a complementary layer instead of replacing or Yeah, and then the other issue I always thought about was why are we always trying to build AI to model like what we think of as the human brain? Like, isn't there more interesting things that we can do? Other ways that we can try and think with, because our brains are not computers and computers are not brains. And can we use that to do what that processing actually does differently than what we can do and start to think of complementary types of intelligence?
There's something really interesting about that terminology for kind of neural nets and these kind of concepts, that it is essentially needs to be able to mimic our brains with the assumption that our brains are pretty much the best thing out there. And that's the one that you should be following. One more question I think we have time for. You had your hand up, I think.
Thank you. I think you have kind of touched on it because tonight was about AI and being humane, but I guess my question was, does that matter and what is being humane and why does AI have to be humane?
Showstopper. No, it's a good question. We were actually talking about this while we were kind of clustered out here having a chat before the talk. And we were discussing this again in the context of kind of ecological approaches. And does it actually have to be about humans at all? Does there need to be anything humane in it? What does it actually mean to be humane, which is an incredibly fraught word and concept anyway? And there is also something potentially interesting, although it's not quite as binary as this, around what would it mean to, again, look at creating these models in ways that don't actually try to mimic us in the very kind of egocentric way. And with that, I think we are pretty much at time. So thank you, everyone. I'm Bri Trevina. Thank you for letting me host tonight, Kalari Stilling and Nishin Mahani.
You've been listening to an MPavilion podcast recorded on the lands of the Eastern Kulin Nation. For more, visit our archive at mpavilion.org and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.